Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation today, why some organic food lovers are now saying genetically modified foods might actually help some of their causes. But first, it's the first full day of a new reality for General Motors and Chrysler now that the Obama administration has ordered the two struggling car makers to get their act together before they get any more bailout money. Fritz Anderson, the man who took over at GM yesterday after CEO Rick Wagoner was forced by the Obama administration to quit, held his first news conference. He said the company may need to close more plants, in addition to the five it already told the government it would shutter. And he said he's working round the clock to turn the company around in the next 60 days to try to avoid what Obama calls a quick rinse bankruptcy.
We know that basically by no later than June 1st, if we're not able to accomplish this outside of bankruptcy, we would be in bankruptcy. It's pretty clear the government was unequivocal in that regard. And, you know, frankly, from our perspective, we don't need any more time to be able to try to get this done. More time isn't going to help the process.
Joining us on the line, Mike Ramsey, automotive reporter for Bloomberg News in Detroit. And Mike, Henderson was also asked, what's the difference between you and CEO Rick Wagoner? And he seemed to indicate that one difference might be that Henderson was willing to accept bankruptcy. Does that mean Wagoner wasn't?
Well, I think that Fritz is a great financial mind, and he's also kind of known to be maybe a little bit more on the tough side than Rick. And Rick, I wouldn't want to say that he was sentimental about it, but he had difference of opinions with Fritz on a number of issues. The GM and Chrysler merger idea, I think Fritz was more of a fan of. And so there are differences between the two.
Tell us more of the differences as you see them.
Well, you know, Fritz, saying they're different, they had very similar backgrounds coming up through the company, and certainly, and personality-wise, Fritz is a nice fellow as well as Rick was. But I think that he, you know, sort of been known as a guy who makes maybe quicker decisions, wants to move a little bit faster, is a little bit tougher. Maybe I don't want to say brutal, but you know, he's willing to make tougher decisions. So those are distinguishing characteristics there.
Right. Well, in addition, GM announced a program to help people make their car payments if they lose their jobs. It's called the Total Confidence Program. Ford quickly followed suit with a similar program. But Hyundai announced its own program last January. So is this seen as GM quickly catching up or, you know, still lagging behind? How's that being read?
Well, I would say that I'm surprised that they didn't do this immediately after the first sales report came out from Hyundai. It just may have taken a while to pull it together. But, I think that obviously Hyundai was very successful with this program, and I'll be surprised if others don't follow suit quickly. This is the kind of thing that, probably has a very little low entry cost but could help drive some sales. There's no pride here. I mean, I think that everyone knows Hyundai started it, but if it works, it works.
Yeah. Well, let's take a quick look at Chrysler. We understand the head of Fiat has flown to Detroit to talk with Chrysler. Again, the Obama administration gave Chrysler 30 days to come up with a merger. Is this a done deal? There were some reports yesterday, and then they were pulled back. What's going on there?
Well, I think that some of it is in the language of, maybe possibly a marketing angle here. The agreement they've had this agreement since January to have an alliance. What may have changed is under Treasury's direction, the details of the agreement, the entry-level ownership stake that Fiat would take and its maximum amount that it could take had to be changed. And Treasury pretty much said, look, we recognize there's no way Chrysler is going to make it without more help. It just didn't have the money to develop new products.
Right.
So
they're still working on the deal?
They're still working on it. It's not a final deal. Right. Fiat does not own a percentage of Chrysler right now.
Mike, you're there in Detroit. Just quickly, in the few seconds we have, how's the city today? You know, how's the region reacting to all of this?
You know, I think that there's a level of concern, but also this has been going on for a long time, and I think that there's also just a frustration that, you know, that there's more to this area than you know, the auto industry, and that it's, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. It's sunny today here, and I think that, you know, everyone would probably just be relieved to have some sort of resolution to it.
Yeah. Mike Ramsey, automotive reporter for Bloomberg News Service there in Detroit. Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you.
quick. I say genetically modified organisms or food, and you say what? Well, if you're for them, you might say bug-resistant crops. If you're against them, you're probably saying Frankenfoods. Environmentalists and organic food lovers have long considered genetically modified foods a monstrous lab experiment waiting to go terribly wrong. But James McWilliams says that might be changing. He's among a small but growing number of organic and sustainable food lovers who are coming around to the idea that GMO foods might have a role to play in sustaining a good environment. McWilliams is associate professor of history at Texas State University. He writes widely on the history and ethics of food. It's always thought-provoking. You can get to his blog on ethical eating at our website, hereandnow.org. And James joins us in the studio. Welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me back.
You sort of set yourself up as a kind of centrist and reasonable voice in the middle of the food debate. When you were here last, you took the stand that organic food transported a great distance is really worse for the environment than locally produced, but maybe non-organic food because of all the energy that gets expended trucking it around. Now, your take on GMOs. Let's first start out by defining them. Remind us again.
Well, a genetically modified organism or genetically modified crop is a crop that has had its DNA changed to convey a desirable trait, such as insect resistance or drought resistance.
Right. So you take a gene from one organism and you inject it into the DNA sequence of, let's say, cotton.
There is a gene gun that does this.
It's amazing.
In a lot of ways, this is a sticking point with a lot of the opposition to genetically modified crops is that, you know, it is something that does not happen in quote-unquote nature.
No, it doesn't. But when you take this gene gun and you insert this gene from one organism into another, you can create a crop that might have insect resistance or drought tolerance or herbicide resistance. Well, you know, we'll talk about what some of the criticism is, but what do you think the benefits of GMOs are?
The potential benefits include contributions to medium-sized and even small-scale sustainable agriculture. And you know, I'll give you a concrete example of how this might work. It's becoming an increasingly popular opinion that eating meat has pretty severe environmental consequences. One caveat in this is often grass-fed beef. I mean, the benefits of grass-fed beef are, you know, that they're eating grass and not corn, and so an enormous chunk of the supply chain is taken out.
And in addition, when they're eating feed, they're often being also force-fed antibiotics, growth hormones, steroids, I'm reading from one of your articles here, appetite enhancers, so that you get those as well.
Yeah, it's a gruesome mix that they choke down.
So grass is better, except
grass is much better, but you know, rarely mentioned is the fact that, you know, grass-fed cattle produce four times as much methane as feed-fed cattle. Methane is one of the most harmful greenhouse gases. It's 20 times more powerful than carbon dioxide in terms of causing global warming. Now, there is a genetically modified grass, and this genetically modified grass lacks something called lignin. Lignin is actually what produces the methane in a cow's gut, and so they've modified this grass without lignin and could therefore reduce this methane emission. It was pioneered in Australia, and it certainly has not hit the market yet, but I look at a case like this, and I think, well, look, there's real potential to do some environmental good here and get us off the feed system onto the grass system while getting rid of the methane problem. But when the Frankenfood image hovers over a lot of this technology, many producers are incredibly reluctant to undertake it.
How would you say, I mean, how many genetically modified crops do you think we have in the U.S.?
Well, right now, I mean, and this is a big issue. Right now, the major genetically modified crops that are on the market are soybeans. 89% of the world's soybean production is genetically modified. Corn, the number now is about 80% of corn is genetically modified. And cotton, the majority of cotton that's produced right now is genetically modified.
And how are they each modified?
In different ways. Corn and cotton are modified to be insect resistant. A gene to produce a protein to create a bacterium that leads to insect resistance is injected into these crops. They're called BT corn or BT cotton is probably how you've heard of them. Whereas with soy, they're genetically modified to be herbicide resistant, primarily to glyphosate herbicides, which kill all the weeds around it, but the crop survives.
Okay. You and others have pointed out that human beings have long genetically tinkered with crops and livestock, but this is different. I mean, when you breed a cow to be bigger, you're just sort of boosting what it already has. This is introducing something completely alien to a plant or animal. Indian scientist and anti-GMO activist Vandana Shiva, you're familiar with her. She argues that, for instance, you mentioned BT cotton. This is cotton that is engineered to control bollworms. But she says that now, as a result, other pests have exploded. Suddenly there's all sorts of, you know, you tamp down one pest with GMOs and you cause another population to explode because somehow a natural cycle has been disrupted. You mentioned engineering plants to be resistant to weed killers so that they don't get killed by a weed killer. It's just like the use of antibiotics. If you have done this, do you also create maybe a super weed that's resistant to the herbicide?
Well, I mean, let's keep one thing in mind here, and that is that the process of intervening into the natural world and creating agricultural systems in and of itself means that we are disrupting the natural cycles of nature. So Vandana Shiva is absolutely right that in suppressing the American bollworm, which is the major destroyer of cotton in India, without BT cotton, could potentially lead to the emergence of other soil bacterium, other fungi, other invasive insects. That is very true. On the other hand, the same process takes place with conventional crops. You know, I looked at 300 years of this in the United States, and whenever farmers came up with a quote-unquote solution to a pest problem, others arose. Advocates of genetically modified crops are not saying this is the answer to all of our insect problems. What they're saying is that this needs to be a sharpened tool in a large box of other tools.
Well, and the biggest complaint, or the biggest fear, I guess I should say, is that genetically modified crops, and you just gave us an idea of how many there are out there, that crops don't stand still, seeds don't stand still, pods don't stand still, and so that they're, you know, being blown around and cross-pollinating with non-GMOs, and therefore we're losing any non-GMOs. We don't have a choice.
Yeah. The fear here is that we're going to lead to a fundamental loss of biodiversity because the pollen from, say, an herbicide-resistant crop is going to blow to a wild relative. And it's going to create a war, and the wild version of that crop will not be able to compete with the genetically modified version of that crop.
Right.
That has not happened. 2 billion acres of genetically modified crops have been planted, and we have not seen that happen. It's because of the sort of far-flung nature of our food supply, we have crops planted all over the world nowhere near where their wild relatives are growing. Now, even if they were growing close proximity, plant biologists make a very good point, which is crops make lousy weeds. They need humans there to help them survive. And so it's incredibly unlikely that a genetically modified crop let out into the wild to compete with its wild relative could survive.
That's food historian James McWilliams. We have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll ask, what about conventional and organic crops, not wild crops, those we know are being tainted by windblown GMO seeds? And we'll also ask about the role that these seeds play in the huge number of suicides among farmers in India. Prince Charles is also going to make his way into the conversation. And if you have thoughts, go to our website, herenow.org, and click on Contact Us, send an email. Later today, how a Nerf basketball-playing robot helps kids with autism. We'll be back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. Food historian James McWilliams is with us. He's making the argument that proponents of sustainable and organic food, like him, should stop seeing genetically modified food as the enemy. He says that GMOs can actually be good for the environment, at least in some instances. Just before the break, Jimmy was saying that one fear of GMOs, that they might infect or even wipe out their wild cousins, is misplaced because GMO crops aren't planted near wild ones. And in any case, scientists believe that GMO crops can't really survive in the wild. But James, that's the wild crop. What about a crop that an organic or even a conventional farmer wants to keep free of genetically modified seeds? They can't.
This is an extremely legitimate fear, and that cross-pollination has happened, it does happen, and it's unfair to the organic farmer. I guess my take on this is to sort of accept that as a possible downside of this technology, and only accepting that when I weigh it against the many benefits that I think this technology could bring. But I would like to add one more thing here. We are also talking about corn, cotton, and soy mainly. And in a lot of ways, that's the problem. I mean, genetically modified technology is being grossly misapplied right now. It's being applied to support monoculture. It's being applied to support the worst forms of industrial agriculture. And the kind of problem that we're talking about right now, this cross-contamination, would be greatly diminished if farmers were actually practicing diversified agriculture using genetically modified crops. And so my advocacy, cautious advocacy, is really with an eye towards what how it could be used rather than to how it is being used right now.
Well, and you note that there are some organic farmers who first had what would be the first typical reaction to this idea of mad experiments with food and now are coming over to have changed their mind. You talk about Pamela Ronald. She's chair of the Plant Genomics Program at UC Davis. She was a huge critic of GMOs, and now you write has changed her mind. Why?
I read Dr. Ronald's book, Tomorrow's Table, which came out in 2008, and it was a really fascinating book because she is a strong supporter of sustainable agriculture and a strong supporter of organic agriculture. And she argues in her book that, you know, these two systems, the organic system and genetically modified system, could overlap powerfully and in greatly beneficial ways for the interests of sustainable agriculture. She has worked specifically on a genetically modified rice that is resistant to a particular soil bacterium. She sees it as a way to turn a lot of Asian rice farmers over to organic agriculture. If you adopt this rice, it reduces the need for a lot of the chemical inputs that you would otherwise have to use. And even one more point to this, speaking to this organic genetically modified overlap, you know, BT, and we talked about BT corn, we talked about BT cotton. Bacillus thuringiensis is what that is called. And since 1958, organic farmers have been using Bacillus thuringiensis in powdered form as organic insect control. But it's the fact that the gene from it is inserted into the crops in a laboratory that creates the great fear about BT corn and BT cotton.
Well, you know, we bounce back and forth between the pros and the cons. Here's another con from Vandana Shiva. She says that 150,000 farmers, cotton farmers in India, have committed suicide because, she says, their seeds have been destroyed for different reasons. And so now these farmers, she says, are forced to buy seeds at a very high price every year from Monsanto, and these are GMO because it's all that's available to them. It drives up their debt and drives up these suicide rates. She started seed banks across India so that these farmers can receive these non-GMO seeds and not have these huge debts and also have to use all the, by her account, all the fertilizers and things that have to be used with GMO plants. They have less costs, and in the areas where they don't have to buy the GMO seeds, they have less suicide rates.
You know, in terms of this argument that the genetically modified crops are leading to farmer suicides, I'm not so comfortable with that direct correlation. Whereas if you want to say that genetically modified organisms are a potent symbol of larger agricultural industrialization and that larger agricultural industrialization is creating this massive depression that's leading to suicide, I think I might be more inclined to go along with that. I mean, let's not forget that with any form of technology, it was monopolized by a small group of people very early on and was often not used to very beneficial purposes. Now, this could be very true with genetically modified crops as well. So I would like to see them more democratized and the information become part of the public domain. And I think we will see organizations like the Gates Foundation start to undertake and fund experiments and provide incentives for scientists. I mean, technology goes where the money is. And if there's money to produce drought-resistant cassava that African farmers can use to provide regional self-sufficiency, I certainly think science will go in that direction.
By the way, Prince Charles, you laugh, very much against GMOs. What would you say? What's the one thing you would say to him?
He won't support them because they're not in harmony with nature. I think that's a direct quote. If not, it's a very close paraphrase. I guess my question would be, and of course it would be very friendly and respectful, what is nature? And nothing is natural in an agricultural system, as I see it. As I see it and others see it, the act of farming is a direct intervention into the cycles of an environment that was once untouched by human intervention. I interviewed a plant biologist, and she said, oh, agriculture is like pouring cement on the land. Now, I mean, her point was overstated, but what she was saying is if you take a system that's experiencing a certain level of biodiversity, doesn't matter if you're an organic farmer or not, and you reduce it to a handful of crops, you are significantly compromising that biodiversity. And you are turning the land over into a selection of carefully chosen biota that are going to serve your environmental, they're going to serve your commercial, that are going to serve your philosophical needs. Do you think Prince Charles would go for that?
I don't know. James E. McWilliams, his forthcoming book is coming out this August, is called Just Food. We'll have you back for that, and I'm wondering already, is it just as in justice or just as in simply?
Well, that's the brilliance of the title,
there
right?
There you go. Okay. He's also Associate Professor of History at Texas State University and authored the piece, The Green Monster, Could Frankenfoods Be Good for the Environment? In Slate, and we'll hook you up to that at our website, herenow.org. James, always thought-provoking when you come by. Thank you.
Well, thanks again for having me.
And by the way, tomorrow on Here and Now, frogs. Why some of them are disappearing, maybe because of things in the environment like pesticide, but also we'll go to an extraordinary exhibit at the Boston's Museum of Science and hold the big ones and listen to the small ones. Frogs tomorrow on Here and Now. Back after the latest news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Tomorrow is April 1st, and hopefully the joke won't be on us. You may have heard a malicious computer worm has been quietly infecting millions of computers. Tomorrow, those computers are expected to get a new command, and no one knows if that means crashing the internet or just sending Happy April Fool's Day cards. There has been speculation that the worm's authors could be anywhere from Russia to China, and Microsoft has offered a $250,000 reward for information on them. Jose Nazario is manager of security research at Arbor Networks. He's speaking to us from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and he's been coordinating with other security specialists around the world to quash this worm known as Conficker. Jose, how does Conficker work?
The basic goal of a computer worm is to propagate from one system to another. In this case, it does so by searching out computers with a specific vulnerability in the Windows operating system. It also likes to propagate over the Windows file sharing network and most effectively over USB keys.
These are little thumb drives.
Exactly. So when your PC is infected, you plug yours in, the worm copies itself to your thumb drive, and when you take it over to your friends to share, for example, a large presentation file, they're now infected as well.
And why do people like yourself think that it's getting a command tomorrow?
A few weeks ago, a new version of this worm appeared. Analysis showed that it had what we call a trigger date. This is a specific time and date that it switches its behaviors. So on April 1st, it appears that all these different infected PCs are going to look for updates in new locations, trying to basically evade efforts that have largely shut out the attacker.
So it sounds as if we have this army of zombie computers waiting for a command, and when they get one, they will act. But until then, how do you know that your computer is infected?
There's a few different ways. The swarm actually blocks you from getting to antivirus sites, basically trying to prevent you from removing it.
These are sites like Microsoft.com or Symantec.com, sites that can give you protective software. So if your computer is keeping you from going there, you know, you may be infected. We'll link you to those sites, by the way, at our website, hereandnow.org. But, Jose, what's the goal of the worm? At one point, Internet scams were just to wreak havoc. Now they're being used to make a profit. We're reading this network of infected computers could be rented out to other bad guys on the black market to use in their scams.
There's a huge shadow economy for these kinds of operations where spammers, for example, can hire programmers to build them a spam botnet. There are people who are trading in, for example, stolen information. And so tracking the money and tracking sort of the business opportunities can get a little bit tricky and very murky very, very quickly.
Well, in this botnet, this is this group of zombie computers that we spoke of, but it just feels as if, yes, this is a shadow economy, but if the authors are coming out of the shadow enough to interact with other bad guys, it just feels as if they're opening themselves up to internet detectives finding them.
That's exactly our hope. So many people are looking, so many people are keeping an eye out, that we're hoping that we can learn more about them, that they either might make a mistake, or if they make a few moves, that we can gather information and say, oh, they were in this location this time, therefore it might be one of these people.
Well, what do you think is going to happen tomorrow? The British House of Commons was hit by Conficker. CBS News found its machines had the worm while they were preparing a report for 60 Minutes. There's fear that governments and news agency websites could be under control of Conficker. What do you think is going to happen, and how are you preparing?
Well, we know that there are millions of machines, millions of PCs all over the world that are infected. Basically, every network has an infection somewhere, at least. We don't quite know what's going to happen tomorrow. We think it'll be a non-event. We're hoping it is, at least, if nothing sort of catastrophic happens. We have been reaching out to networks and enterprises who run them to alert them. Here, we found information about your network that reveals that these PCs are infected. You know, we also have tools to help you clean up those machines. So we're working, trying to alert people that they have these problems and they can clean them up.
Well, and some analysts have pointed out that because the Conficker authors are likely making money off this worm, it's unlikely that they're going to want to crash the web.
That's just it. When the Internet runs, these guys can do business. If the Internet's not working right, they can't really work. They rely on it.
That's Jose Nazario, Manager of Security Research at Arbor Network, speaking to us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Jose, thanks, and best of luck to you tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
To all of us, actually. Hopefully we'll be able to tell you what happened. Back in half a minute, here and now. Welcome back to Here and Now. Robots can explore the ocean floor, defuse roadside bombs, but they can also play Nerf basketball, and that may help in treating children with autism. Neelanjan Sardkar is a professor of mechanical engineering at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. He's designing robots to work with autistic children to teach them better social skills. Professor Sardkar joins us from a studio at Vanderbilt. And Professor, first remind us, we know there's an autism spectrum, some children much more highly functioning than others. But give us an overall sense of the problem many autistic children have with social skills.
Basically, the children with autism have some kind of problem in interacting with other people. And they may not be able to look at their eyes, or they may feel uncomfortable in talking to unknown people. And basically, they remain isolated and aloof.
You know, one thing we think of immediately is robots also, you know, don't express emotions. But what was your thinking about why robots might help?
One of the problems of children with autism interacting with other people is that the people in general are unpredictable. So these children don't know what to expect from other people in a predictable manner. So in a robot, you can program it in a more predictable manner. And then you can introduce some unknown uncertainty very gradually so that these children don't feel uncomfortable interacting with a robot.
What you've done is develop a method that uses physiological measurements, heart rate, skin response, temperature, muscle response, to monitor the emotional state of children with autism, and you hook them up, in effect, to robots in ways that, you know, that are comfortable for them.
Right.
And then the robot plays games with them.
In this robotic system that we have created, the children play Nerf basketball games with the robot. At the same time, their physiological signals are being monitored by the robot. And robot takes these signals and makes some intelligent inference based on what the child might be feeling.
So all of this information is fed into the robot. The robot, in effect, when it's programmed, knows this child and knows what the reactions are.
Right.
And then the exciting part, the robot can respond to this child. Let's say if it's a game of Nerf basketball, they can lower the hoop if the child's getting anxious so they play better. How important is that, that an autistic child might finally have someone, something, that can read its emotions and respond?
All the children that we have studied, they really like this system. They liked playing with a robot that can, quote-unquote, understand how they are feeling.
Do you have any concerns, Professor, about children with autism who are so already so locked in, you know, interacting with a machine and maybe then now being locked in with a machine?
The ultimate goal is, can the robot be useful in teaching them some social skill? The goal is not to make them like the robot so much that they avoid other people. That will be a tragedy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would imagine right now this is very expensive. There's, you know, certainly can't be robots for every child with autism in therapy. So what's the next step?
Once we have been able to demonstrate that it is scientifically feasible to create such a system that can sense the emotion of this child with autism, the next step for us is to create robot in software environment, like virtual robot. And we want to create social scene. This will be much closer to your real life social situation, where the child actually has to go out and eat in a cafeteria with other children in his or her class.
In other words, they get to go to lunch on their computers before they learn how to do that in real life. That's Neelanjan Sarkar, Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. Let's turn now to Tanya Mertes. She's a parent representative at the Autism Society of Middle Tennessee in Nashville. Her 16-year-old son Daniel is autistic and participated in Professor Sarkar's robotics program 3 years ago. Tanya jokes that Daniel likes to take part in research to get the gift cards they hand out. But Tanya, you also told us he's a high-functioning child, academically on pace with his classmates, but socially more on the level of a preteen. So what was it like when you and Daniel first walked into Professor Sarkar's lab?
Well, I have to say, I mean, I think he and I were both a little surprised when you mentioned robot. You know, we're thinking a little thing with wheels,
right,
and arms
R2-D2.
And legs. Yeah, but it was really just like a post that went up and down that had a basketball hoop on it. You know, we were like, oh, that's the robot. This is really neat. And so then we were, you know, really wondering, well, how is this thing going to interact and change based on Daniel's reactions?
Did you find that the robot could sort of read his moods? What happened?
He was throwing these balls into the hoop, and of course, you know, he wanted to make the basket. And, you know, it would move back and forth or up and down, and you could tell at some point that he was getting frustrated because he couldn't make the basket. And so then it would slow down, or it would stay more stationary until he was successful, and then it would start, you know, changing it around a bit.
So you're saying that this device perhaps read his frustration and was able to react to it?
Yes.
For some kids with autism, that would mean everything, because people can't read their emotions.
Yeah. It really would, because a lot of times if they get frustrated, they're just going to give up, and that's it. The fact that if a robot could see these changes coming on and catch the frustration level and then change it to keep the child engaged, I mean, that would be huge.
How was it for Daniel when that happened?
He became more animated. The smile came back on his face. He was making baskets, and you could tell he felt successful enough that he wanted to continue.
What do you hope? I mean, again, we know Daniel's hope is that he gets a gift card, but what is, you know, your hope that this research leads to? I mean, what are you envisioning?
I think I could envision just whether it be through computer or hands-on toys or, you know, something to help engage, especially a young child. I'm thinking anywhere in the range of 2 to 4-year-olds, something that could help engage them with joint attention. I mean, because that's a huge thing in kids with autism.
And joint attention?
Yeah, joint attention, just the sharing, the sharing back and forth of something. I mean, young kids with autism tend not to share, they may go and find a toy. And, you know, a typical child would kind of bring it up to you, and they would look at you and look at the car. They would look at you and look at the little toy car. Whereas a child with autism would just take the little car and play with it. It wouldn't occur to them to go and share that enjoyment. And I think that through a robot, if that could help keep that engagement, I mean, even though it is a robot, there would still be some social component there.
Yeah, in other words, it's a robot, but it's something that's reacting. It's not just a passive toy, a car.
We already know that they tend to be more engaged with computers and electronics anyway, so why not take that and use that to their advantage?
Right. Well, and as we wait for the benefits of research like Professor Sarkar's, here you are working with, as we said, the Autism Society of Middle Tennessee. Mm-hmm. What would you say to parents who are where you were, you know, 15 years ago, who are just starting with a child who's been diagnosed? What would you say to them?
I would encourage them to get really good early intervention and to learn how to become a good advocate for their child, because nobody else can help their child get better like their parent can. And that means learning your rights, learning the child's rights. And I think, too, just staying positive. This is not the journey that you thought you were going to be on, but the joys, there are joys and there are blessings. If somebody would have told me back when Daniel was 2 where he would be today, I wouldn't have believed them. So I just continue to live it day by day, knowing that I can't predict where he'll even be 5 years from now.
Yeah. That's Tanya Mertes. Her son, 16-year-old Daniel Mertes, participated in a program at Vanderbilt University designed for children with autism to work with robotics. Tanya's been speaking to us from Nashville, Tennessee. And Tanya, we thank you so much and wish you the best.
Thank you.
Missed anything? Go to our website, hereandnow.org, and listen again or download a podcast. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. That's the sound of Goran Bregovic, a performer who sold 15 million records over the past three decades. The son of a Serbian mother and a Croatian father who was an officer in the Yugoslav People's Army, Goran Bregovic is a rock star, a film score composer, and the leader of a 40-piece ensemble called the Weddings and Funerals Orchestra, which crowds the stage with a Serbian gypsy band, a 12-string classical group, a 15-man choir, electric guitar and drums, and female Bulgarian vocalists. In this story from the BBC, Goran Bregovic talks about his family's influence on the music on his latest album, Alcohol.
My mother divorced my father because, like most officers, he drank too much shljivica. After she left him, he underwent treatment to stop drinking. For the next 15 years, he didn't drink. My mother died of leukemia. My father's second wife told me that she had followed him secretly a few times. Night after night, she would find him smoking, sitting till dawn under the windows of the room where my mother lay dying on the third floor of the military hospital in Split. After her death, he returned to his village on the Hungarian border and planted a vineyard that yields 1,000 liters per year. He survived my mother by 20 years and drank those 1,000 liters more or less alone. I dedicate alcohol to my parents. Alcohol! Usually I don't drink. The only place where I drink is stage. By the contract, I must have alcohol on stage, and I drink there. So I was thinking maybe I could do one record, like a soundtrack for drinking. Because I always imagine my records as soundtracks. Some of them are for the movies, but some of them are a soundtrack for the movies in my head, and it could be soundtrack for the movies in your head. I was starting to thinking about one soundtrack for the drinking. And immediately I knew that I would like to do two records, one for the strong alcohol, so this is first part called Šljivovica, which is our strong alcohol, it's brandy from plum. It's brass music for heavy alcohol and for dancing, so you all will have immediately imagined of the girls jumping on the tables, then custom is that trumpeters, they start to play under the skirts of the girls and climbing up the trumpets under the skirt. So this record is for that. If you play music in Balkans, you do gypsy job. It doesn't matter if you are gypsy or not, music is considered as a gypsy job. The name of my orchestra is Wedding and Funeral Orchestra. And at the beginning, I called them like this for as a joke, because before they played with me, they played weddings and funerals like all the musicians of that type do on the Balkans. I'm from tradition where still wedding and funeral are two most important moments in everybody's life, not only personally, but also as socially. So the music that is played there is important. And the custom is to play on the funeral favorite music of someone who died. So this is why it could happen that even danceable music will be played on the funeral. And that's why the same musicians who are specialists in weddings, they are specialists in funerals. So my musicians, before they play with me, they play a lot of weddings and funerals. Even when they play wedding parties or funerals, they never play all the party. There is another band who play wedding party. They just jump in for half an hour. They make a little madness because they play old military instruments, which is impossible to perfectly tune. So it's a little bit like on the beginning of punk. It's a little bit out of tune, so it makes not only music, it makes a little madness all the time. And this is my favorite artillery, how to say. When I compare with electric guitar that I played all my life, electric guitar is like harp comparing with military brass. It's difficult to say what is gypsy music, because from India till England, there is gypsy music very different. It's always eclectic. It's always modern, not because they are fashionable people, it's because they have to survive. And because they have to survive, they are good. It's a question of life and death, and they have to be good.
The Balkan superstar Goran Bregovic speaking to the BBC about his music and his latest CD, Alcohol. For more, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. Well, before we go, we want to note a passing. Oscar-winning composer Maurice Jarre, who captured the majesty of the desert in his music for the film Lawrence of Arabia, died Sunday in his villa in California, where he'd lived for decades. Born in 1924 in Lyon, France, Jarre studied music in Paris, training initially as a kettle drum player, and started his career composing scores for theatrical productions before branching out to movie soundtracks. In 1961, he won his first Oscar for his score for director David Lean's Lawrence of Arabia, and they became a magical team. Jarre's second Oscar came in 1965 for his work on David Lean's Dr. Zhivago. Jarre collaborated with Lean again in 1984, winning his third Academy Award for A Passage to India. In all, he contributed to more than 150 soundtracks. But Zhivago's Lara's theme became a hit single and was recognized around the world. Can't you just picture Julie Christie in that big white hat and all that snow? Maurice Jarre was 84.